I'm delighted right now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Marshall Curry. He's director of the film If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front, which is screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the CCA, sponsored by New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a film about a group of what are called by some eco-terrorists, by others liberators, whose concern about the Earth and their frustration in trying to save the environment through the normal means of protest and letter writing resulted in the Earth Liberation Front. How did you come across this story, and how did you come across Daniel McGowan in particular? He's the subject of the film.
Right. Well, it's really a story that just dropped in my lap. My wife was running a domestic violence organization in Brooklyn and came home from work one day and said, "You'll never guess what happened at work today. Four federal agents walked into the office and arrested that guy, Daniel McGowan." And he was somebody who we knew, she knew well, I knew a little bit just through her. And he was accused of having taken part in two multi-million dollar arsons of timber companies some years before when he was part of the Earth Liberation Front.
And so you had a personal connection to him. He's such an amiable guy. One comes to really like him during the course of the film. And I have to say, as documentaries go, it's one of those really beautifully made films that fills the viewer, at least this particular viewer, with feelings of conflict and real emotion, because you kind of see both sides of the conflict. You see these folks like Daniel McGowan and his friends coming, I mean, he's a Brooklyn boy, then he comes into an ecological consciousness which wasn't fostered in his family at all, and kind of goes out to the West Coast, to Oregon, and gets involved in trying to save the very last bits of old growth forest. And it turns out that, as I sort of said before, the normal means for doing that just don't work.
Right. I mean, in some ways, it's a coming-of-age story about somebody who, as you mentioned, has a very unlikely background. He'd grown up in Rockaway, Queens. His dad was a New York cop. You know, he was a business major in college, never spent the night outdoors when he graduated from college. And he discovered wilderness later in life, you know, in his 20s, and got very involved in the environmental movement and started out letter writing and petition gathering, and didn't feel like that was being effective, and so he got involved in sit-ins and civil disobedience. Then he moved on to small acts of destruction, what, you know, a lot of people in the environmental scene call monkey wrenching, and ultimately got involved in these huge arsons that the Earth Liberation Front was doing, and then took a step back and had second thoughts about those fires and second thoughts about the use of arson as a tactic. I mean, obviously, it's very dangerous and it's extremely destructive, and a lot of people argue that it's counterproductive if your goal is to you know, win converts. But a few years, he ended up leaving the Earth Liberation Front, moving back to New York after having been living in Eugene, Oregon for a number of years. And it was through a number of different events that are kind of dramatic parts of the story that the police were able to finally crack the group and rounded up ultimately about 14 members of the Earth Liberation Front in what they called the biggest domestic terrorism takedown in the history of the United States.
It's extraordinary that it was so long before they were caught. They were actually pretty skilled criminals in terms of really covering their tracks, and it was only a kind of sort of lucky break and very, very hard work on the part of the authorities, and then basically flipping a guy who turned against all of his former comrades that got any of these guys caught at all. But when you look at the arsons that they did, again, you're here I am watching this DVD and thinking about tactics and thinking about strategies. And there was this one example in the film of a slaughterhouse and the BLM was rounding up wild horses on government land, sending them to a slaughterhouse. The slaughterhouse was so poorly run that the blood from the slaughterhouse was contaminating the water supply in its community. They wrote letters. They protested for a decade. Nothing happened. Finally, they burned it down. And it actually, for better or worse, it actually did solve the problem.
It's that example is the one that's most often cited by supporters of the Earth Liberation Front, because that company went out of business, they weren't able to get permits to rebuild, and that was it. Of course, there are also arsons that they took part in that are a lot more controversial that the movie explores as well.
Well, exactly. There were ones where they didn't even really study the situation that they were burning down, the place that they were burning down, enough to know what it was really doing. And if they had, they wouldn't have done it. And you're watching that and you're just holding your head in your hands going, oh my goodness, how could these well-meaning people be so stupid?
Yeah, the movie really does wrestle with questions of tactics and what are effective tactics and what are ethical tactics. And with the emergence of the Occupy Wall Street movement, or the Occupy Everything movement now, this film, which was kind of historical when it came out this summer, has since become really part of that argument. And it's been interesting for us to see the Occupy movement take the film to argue about. I mean, they've had screenings at Occupy Oakland and places like that. DVDs are sort of making their way around. And within that group, people are saying, well, what lessons can we learn? What mistakes can we avoid? And similarly, it's been interesting to see law enforcement responses, because the film is a cautionary tale to activists, and it's also a cautionary tale to the government, because the police in the 90s reacted with, you know, incredible abusive uses of pepper spray on people who were doing nonviolent civil disobedience, and it really radicalized people. And I think that, as a number of, you know, policemen have told me, you know, they understand that there are reactions to protests that radicalize people, and there are reactions that bring people into the democratic argument. And so hopefully the film is kind of generating thought and self-examination on both sides.
One thing that the film doesn't really touch on, but is the subtext, I think, of the entire film, is one of the basic questions raised by Occupy and by practically everybody else in this country at this point, is the role of money in politics. So you have the Forest Service at the beginning of the film, and it's explained that their role is supposed to be to protect the forest, but actually it's to basically provide as much timber as timber companies want, because timber companies own the legal process to some extent because they have such a strong lobby. And this question of the role of money in politics, I think, underlies the frustration that people feel that make them resort to acts of arson in the first place, because the democratic process actually doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, people definitely felt during that time that they were voiceless, and that the democratic system was broken. It was corrupted by money, it was corrupted by power, and when people feel that way, it leaves them with no choice in their minds except to step out of the system. And whether that's civil disobedience, whether it's dumping sugar in the gas tanks of bulldozers, or in Daniel's case, whether it's arson, it's hard to predict how people will react when they feel voiceless.
There is this question of arson versus terrorism, and we don't want to give away the whole film, so we won't talk about who was caught, who got what sentences, and so on, but there's the question of whether somebody who commits arson should be convicted of arson or convicted of terrorism. And what is the argument for terrorism? How does it relate to 9/11, the Patriot Act, and all of that?
Yeah, that is a big part of what was of the film and what was argued during the time of their trials. Daniel faced life in prison, no parole, for these two arsons, in which nobody was hurt. You know, when you talk to the timber company owner, and we spend time with him, he did feel terrorized. I mean, he describes having built this company up and being afraid afterwards, not knowing who had come in the middle of the night and burned his building down and destroyed all of his property. And he thought, maybe they're going to come to my house. And they got an alarm system at his house. He thought, maybe they're going to burn my children. And, you know, he just didn't know. And so in his mind, when somebody inflicts terror like that, that's the essence of terrorism. People on the other side say, listen, nobody's ever been hurt. Nobody's been killed, and nobody's even been hurt in any of these Earth Liberation Front fires, and there have been many of them. And the reason for that is because the Earth Liberation Front scouts them out and is careful to make sure that they're doing these arsons at night when the cleaning lady's gone and the night watchman's not there. And in their minds, these are like the Boston Tea Party. They're symbolic property destruction designed to draw attention to things that aren't being paid attention to. And in a way, that's kind of a boiled down encapsulation of the two positions. Is, are these guys the Boston Tea Party, or are they Al Qaeda?
Does the Earth Liberation Front or some version of it still exist?
Yeah, well, so the thing about the Earth Liberation Front is that there is no single Earth Liberation Front. There's no leadership. There's no membership roles. It's just sort of it's more of an ideology than it is an organization. So if you and I decided tonight to go burn some SUVs and we spray painted ELF on the wall, that would be the Earth Liberation Front. We would be the Earth Liberation Front. And so the reason that it's set up that way is to make it hard to stamp out. You can crack a cell, but because each cell is individual and doesn't, you know, the people who were in Oregon during those years didn't know who the Earth Liberation Front members in New York were. They just were completely isolated from each other and anonymous. So yes, it still does exist today. As we were editing the film, there were huge fires in Seattle and a huge fire in San Diego. But the subject of the film is the cell that was responsible for the very first Earth Liberation Front fires, and the law enforcement thinks it's probably the largest group responsible for the most fires in America's history.
We're talking to Marshall Curry about the film If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front. One of the things that was, I think, one of the more poignant moments in the film for me is you have a logger who is in the film, and he's saying that the people in his colleagues, basically, the people in his industry, call environmentalists radical, but 95% of the forests in the country have been cut down, and isn't that rather radical in wanting to cut down the last 5% of old-growth forests? Isn't that kind of the radical action? And this is somebody who, I mean, as a lot of loggers claim they do, they actually love the earth and love the forest. And again, it gets back to this question of why is this being done in the way it's being done, and is there any motivation going on besides just pure money and profit?
Yeah, he's a really interesting character. Most of the people who we spoke with, you know, in the beginning or at the beginning of the when we first got to know them, were pretty polarized. The activists really didn't have very much sympathy for the timber companies. The timber companies had no appreciation of what the activists were trying to do. And one of the interesting things about finding him was that he said, you know, I don't have a problem with cutting down trees. I use wood. I use paper. You know, I'm not a fundamentalist about it. But there's got to be a smarter way to do it than clear-cutting these sides of mountains that allow mud to stream in and destroy spawning beds. And there's got to be a better way to get our wood than to cut down trees that are 500 years old or 700 years old or 1,000 years old. And I think probably most people don't even realize that that's where their wood is coming from. And it might be one of those things that the more people start paying attention, in the same way that maybe there's been a movement recently about where our food comes from, if people start thinking a little bit more about where the wood and paper that they're using does come from, maybe that can, you know, build a little bit of pressure on using sustainable forestry instead of clear cuts and old growth logging.
Do you have information on that that you could share with us?
On sort of organizing.
Yeah, how do you know where your paper comes from or your wood comes from?
Well, I guess I don't mean where an individual piece of wood comes from, but what are the policies in America that are dictating that? So, as you pointed out, the Forest Service, which probably most people think, or at least I can tell you, most people in New York think, is job is to protect the forest, is actually part of the Department of Agriculture, and very explicitly they understand that they're a very significant portion of their job is turning forests that are owned by the American people into a source of wood for the timber industry, and they do it at a loss, at a financial loss often. It kind of doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make ecological sense. And at one point, we thought about spending a lot more time exploring the intricacies of timber cutting in the United States in the film. And ultimately, we just had to cut a lot of that out and hope that the film would provoke people to ask some of these questions and to you know, do a little bit of research and find out a little bit more on their own. There's only so much, unfortunately, that you can squeeze into a 90-minute documentary.
Right. When you look at the Earth Liberation Front in retrospect, and I mean, yeah, there may be some fires going on now, but it seems like its main impact was a decade ago or more. When you look at that and you try to evaluate its effectiveness in getting good stuff done, in raising consciousness or activating people or getting laws changed or anything like that, what's your sense of that?
It's really complicated, and I would have conversations with people who still felt that arson was a legitimate tactic and that some of the fires that they had done drew attention to things that people weren't paying attention to. I mean, some folks were saying, listen, when we were burning SUVs, we were just considered kooks. We were trying to draw attention to global warming, and the idea of global warming was this kind of fringy, kooky idea. And now it's mainstream science, and even people who would never agree that you should burn an SUV, doing that sort of thing put that discussion on the map in their minds. Now, I don't know the history enough to know whether, in fact, that was what put it on the map or not, but there are lots of people, including very active, very passionate environmentalists, who think that the Earth Liberation Front did a great disservice to the environmental movement. I talked to folks in Vail, one of the big arsons that the Earth Liberation Front did, that this group that I focused on, the particular cell of the movement, did, was a multi-million dollar facility at Vail, Colorado Ski Lodge. And they were protesting the resort's expansion into national forest. And one of the people who'd been involved in that movement said, before that fire, we were really making progress. We had built a coalition that included, you know, old, crunchy, hippie, tree-hugger types. It included old lady bird watchers. It included yuppies who wanted to take their kids for walks in the forest. And we were really building a coalition of people. And when that fire happened, it completely shattered. And suddenly, a lot of people said, we don't want anything to do with this movement if it's full of crazy people who are going around burning stuff. And the whole discussion became about arson and not about expanding the resort into national forest. So it's definitely a tricky question. Was there anything good that came of these fires? I'm not sure.
It does, above all, I think, raise the question of the role of civil disobedience and the amount of study that is necessary if you're going to do civil disobedience. I think you could probably make an argument that nothing in this country has ever gotten done without civil disobedience, nothing that we respect. I mean, we just got done playing a bunch of Martin Luther King speeches on this show, and that's what it was all about, and positive changes did come from that and weren't going to come without it. And at the same time, you burn down a ski lodge and you get rid of, you'd completely dispel all your credibility. It's definitely an important film to watch, and it is screening tonight at the CCA here in Santa Fe, the Center for Contemporary Arts, which is on the web at ccasantafe.org. Marshall Curry is the director of the film If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front. Do you have a website for that film?
We do. It's ifatreefallsfilm.com. And we also have a Facebook page as well where there's been a lot of activity. I don't know if you know, but it was nominated for an Academy Award yesterday. So
yes, our Facebook congratulations.
Page has been going crazy, and it's been a lot of chatter over on our Facebook page, which is If a Tree Falls over on Facebook.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on that, and above all on the very fine film, and thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
And I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Deborah Dennison. She's the artistic director of the new Arden Shakespeare Festival. And Paul Jeffrey and Gina Michaela are actors. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank Hello. You, Charlotte.
Great to have you all. Now, this weekend, is it Sunday or Saturday?
Sunday the 29th.
Sunday, thank you. I have it right in front of me. This Sunday the 29th is a big event. It's the kind of kickoff to what you're going to be doing. The Arden Shakespeare Festival, you have been up until now the Arden Players.
Yes. So we are evolving into what we plan to be, a major international Shakespeare festival. It may take us a couple of years to get there, but this is the beginning, and I think it's exciting. Last summer, I took a company of players from all of New Mexico, really, of which my two friends here were important parts, to New York and to the Edinburgh Festival with a new play that we'd written. And the company began to form. This is an idea I've had for a while. And the play sold out in New York and was very well received and reviewed both in New York and in Edinburgh. And I thought, you know, we play on the world stage. We can make the world stage. And so we'll bring the world stage back to Santa Fe. In fact, New Mexico, because eventually we plan to tour. We put in place, as soon as we hit the ground, plans for a launch this coming spring and summer. Of what we plan to be a world-class festival of classical plays built around a repertoire of Shakespeare.
So not just Shakespeare?
No, we will do other plays as well. Most Shakespeare festivals do. We'll start out with the greatest living play. Sorry, living. Well, we think he's living. we treat him
Shakespeare, the greatest living playwright.
Greatest living playwright, yeah. Well, in fact, that's the way we treat him. We treat him like a living playwright, not on a pedestal. We treat him as a brilliant contemporary playwright. Not that we do the productions with motorcycles and leather jackets, but...
Although that has been,
it has been
done
yes.
beautifully.
It has been done, more than once. But the approach is that the material is so relevant and so fresh and so amazing for actors to tackle that we approach it as though he wrote the plays yesterday. And they are that relevant, I think.
So this Sunday at Warehouse 21, you are doing two different things. One is called, it's at 2 o'clock, called The Building of the Globe with Louis Fantasia.
Yes.
So we're sorry we couldn't get on the air, but he's flying in at the last minute. And after that, A Taste of Shrew. First, let's talk about Louis Fantasia and The Building of the Globe.
Well, we are incredibly lucky to have as a major advisor, future teacher and director for the festival, one of the major figures in the world Shakespeare scene, in fact, in the world theater scene. Louis has directed more than 100 plays and operas around the world. He was the first American to direct at the Globe in London.
Is that his real name?
Yes, it is. Yes, he was. I think he was born in Boston, actually. He's also a classical musician, quite an accomplished one. And he ran for a number of years the Globe Center's Teaching Shakespeare Through Performance Institute. He's also taught at Juilliard and NYU and California Institute for the Arts. He very kindly has agreed to be one of our... chief advisors. So he's flying out on Friday, and we'll be giving a talk on the extraordinary story of the reconstruction of Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London, of which he was a significant part. I'm told, I have not heard the lecture, although I know quite a lot about the building of the Globe, I'm told it's very entertaining.
Very, very interesting. And then after that is A Taste of Shrew, and I take it that you two, Jeannie and Paul, are acting in that.
What's we are.
It's not just the taming of the shrew. What is it?
It's
well, for the purposes of this, and also for an educational component, which maybe Deborah can also speak about, she has cut down the taming of the shrew so that it will run at just under an hour, which makes it possible to then take it into local schools as part of an outreach component for the festival, which I personally am very excited about.
So it's actually, it's the play just abridged.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Exactly.
And so let's talk about that actual play and what your roles are.
Well, I play Petruchio. Jeannie plays Kate. And Deborah's very cleverly, I think, extracted some of the fizziest and most fun bits of the play and put them together so it still makes sense. It still, and it just makes it, there's a lot of energy. It's, I think, a lot of fun. I think people will, we had this experience, Deborah produced a production of King Lear a couple of years ago, and people came to it and who had never seen Shakespeare ever before and came out and said, "That was fantastic. I understood it." So I think
I understood it is the trick.
Yeah. And I think this is very much along the same lines, and the component that Jeannie was talking about, the just under an hour, so it will fit into a class, an English
right,
class or something.
Right, a period in
yeah,
school.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a lot of fun, and I think, well, it's certainly fun doing it.
And I must say, I have just been laughing at every rehearsal. Deborah is such an insightful director, and the cast is really terrific. They're just
yes,
hilarious.
They are. I'm blessed to have an amazing cast, headed by Jeannie, who's been on Broadway a number of times, and Paul, who's been in the London West End and had a substantial career both in theatre and in film, and Jeannie's done major films. And we have a quality of cast which is simply fabulous. And that's part of the idea, is that what we want to bring to the schools is the very best of the best, so that children exposed to Shakespeare in performance, perhaps for the first time, see something quite wonderful.
Right, and aren't intimidated by mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. And the trick of that is that all the actors know exactly what they're saying. They completely understand the text. And if the actors understand it, so does the audience.
I think that every single person in the United States should be required to take an 8-week course in Elizabethan English. And that way, none of this stuff would be intimidating at all, ever. All you do is you just learn vocabulary lists, and then everything that they... But what's it like to play the shrew, and what is it like to tame her?
If he does.
I was going to say, does he tame
yeah,
me,
right.
though? I definitely end up very sleep-deprived and very, very hungry. but one of the things I love about our approach to this play is that it's not told as a case of this strong, independent woman who very harshly becomes tamed and demeaned into this weak, servile person at the end. That's not at all the story, I think, that Shakespeare intended, and it's certainly not the one that we're telling.
Has it been interpreted that way?
It has, unfortunately,
yeah,
sometimes.
In the past, and I think the way we're approaching it now, which is fascinating to me, is that both Kate and Petruchio are outsiders, in a sense. They neither of them fit in very well to the society and families and that they're finding themselves in, and prejudices. Mm. So they kind of find each other as outsiders and end up kind of appreciating what it is about each other that is valid and worthwhile and good.
Yeah, they really do become allies.
In essence, it's a fabulous love story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, and you can be part of it at Warehouse 21 this weekend. So there's this... Building of the Globe, which is a presentation, presumably with a lot of slides and pictures and things like that?
No, actually, I asked Lewis if he wanted media, and he said, no, I handle it myself. So
really?
Apparently, I mean, I'm going to do some blow-ups so they can see the pictures, but apparently he's used to giving this talk, and he's so entertaining, you don't need visual aid, so I'm looking forward to that.
And that's it, too. And then the performance is from 3 to 3:50, as if you were in English class.
The best one ever.
Yes. And then the... Yeah, exactly. And then the full season begins
I have to add that afterwards we're having a private party for our audience.
Oh, okay.
There's a little reception with the actors, and they can meet Louis Fantasia, and that's following. So we have a little champagne and mulled wine reception afterwards.
Nice. Very nice. And I'm sure that for the kiddies who want to come, there will be
apple cider. And yes, exactly.
So this is all at Warehouse 21. And let's talk about the season that will happen this spring and summer.
Well, we're going to start out with a full version of Shrew. So what you're seeing is kind of a preview of the full production. And then we're probably going to go on and do Measure for Measure. It was a toss-up between Coriolanus and Measure for Measure, both of which deal with subjects that are incredibly relevant today. And I decided that Measure might be the better play to do this season, as Coriolanus requires a lot of sort of Roman swords and a difficult cast. So we're going to go with Measure for Measure, and we have, as I said, this wonderful company of local actors. We have about 15, all of whom I've worked with, who are incredibly skilled and remarkably talented. And the festival will be a locally based cast. We may
Excellent.
Bring in some guest artists, and we may bring in some guest directors, but we are basically a locally based company.
Like these two
Absolutely.
Wonderful people.
Yeah.
That is very cool. More information can be found on the web at asfest.org. That's Arden Shakespeare Festival. And Deborah Dennison is the artistic director. Paul Jeffrey and Gina Michaela are actors. Anything else you want to let our... let me give the telephone number. The telephone number locally for reservations and further information about the event this weekend is 983-4002. Anything else you want to let people know?
Not really, except we're going to have an awful lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, we will see you there this weekend. Thank you so much, Deborah Dennison, Paul Jeffrey, and Jeannie Michaela for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jeff Wheelwright. He's the author of the new book, The Wandering Gene and the Indian Princess, Race, Religion, and DNA. He will be speaking tonight at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 7 o'clock. And then on Sunday at the New Mexico History Museum at 2 o'clock, he will be giving a lecture and book signing. The lecture is called Secret Jews and Telltale Genes in New Mexico. Welcome, Jeff, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this is a fascinating story. It's a story partially about a young woman, Shawnee Medina, who gets breast cancer at the age of 27, and the gene she carried that put her and a lot of women in her family and in the San Luis Valley at risk for breast and ovarian cancer plays a role in the book. It's about the person, it's about the gene. How did you come across this story?
Well, I've been, as a science writer, writing about genetics for about 10 years and always looking for a really interesting story to exercise my interest in genetics, but also my developing interest in religion. And you have when I heard that a Jewish breast cancer mutation showed up in people of colonial New Mexico background, Hispano people, the academics call them, but they're, as you know, Spanish Catholics. So you have a Jewish gene going into people who are part Native American, Spanish Catholic, and then developing breast cancer and high risk of ovarian cancer. And when I got out to investigate this for a magazine story for Smithsonian in 2007, I found this one case. The young woman had already died, but everyone was still talking about her in the little villages that I call Culebra in the southern part of San Luis Valley. They were still talking about this magnetic, beautiful person who died so young, and it has the final complication or interesting twist for me. She was a Jehovah's Witness, and the family had converted in the 1980s to the Jehovah's Witnesses. So there were already three very strong religions on top of my genetic interest.
It brings up your book all kinds of questions about religion and genetics. I mean, what do we even mean by a Jewish gene? How is that traced?
Yeah, that's a bit of a shorthand to call it Jewish gene there, and it's a little bit unfair. Everyone everyone has a copy of, let's say, the BRCA1 gene, the BRCA genes. It's just that this particular mutation that I write about is 10 times more prevalent in people of Jewish ancestry than another mutation might be in your family or in my family. So we all are carrying around potentially hazardous mutations, but in this particular case of this particular people, the risk of inheritance or the risk of being a carrier is much higher.
When you talk about genes that can be traced back 2,500 years, I mean, you're talking in the book about the time of Babylonian captivity. What kind of materials are they using that go back that far to analyze those genes?
Well, you're right that you can't. It's not like mastodon DNA, and somehow you unearth some miraculously preserved DNA. No, this estimate of the age or the origination, if you will, of this mutation of being 2,500 years old is a strong guess based on the fact that different populations of Jews, the Jewish diaspora, they all carry this mutation, but the spelling of it, depending on whether they're in Iraq or whether they're in Italy or whether they're in Ashkenazi Jews who are northern, central, eastern Europe, the spelling is always a little different. And so they rolled back the demographic clock. They figured, well, if the spellings are all different, they were all the same at one time, and when were all Jews together? Well, they were all together at the time of the Babylonian captivity. That's when the first major diaspora of Jews occurred in history, and so it's a strong, strong inference, a strong guess, if you will, that the mutation arose at that time.
Now, this mutation, which, I mean, basically causes a much higher incidence of breast and ovarian cancer in women. If it's so lethal, how did it survive?
Well, the main reason for its persistence is that it's not a recessive mutation. I think behind your question is the notion that you have to put two carriers together to be infected, to develop a disease like in Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis. In which case, carriers, you know, do tend to be healthy, but someone with the disease doesn't make it, and therefore the gene tends to wash out of the population. There's pressure to get rid of it if the person dies. However, if you're going to develop breast cancer from this mutation, you already will have had your children in most cases, even though it strikes very young women, or it can, as in my case, as in the case I write about. It's very possible that Shani Medina, had she chosen to have children, would have had them, and therefore the transmission would have gone on, while the mother was still living. Then she dies later, but it's, for evolution's purposes, it's too late, if you will, to stop it.
Right. This whole set of questions really raises, I mean, there are so many questions about identity and the relationship between race and religion, and how this information is received by the people who find out that they are carrying a Jewish gene and they're Catholic Hispanos who go back generations. How, I mean, I've been living in Santa Fe for over 20 years, and there's been quite a change in people who would not have accepted that they were crypto-Jewish or that they had Jewish heritage, to a much greater acceptance in the time that I've been here. But still, I think it's kind of a shock for some people. What did you find?
Just as you say, I mean, the phenomenon of what's called crypto-Judaism, and I write about this sort of history of this field. It's a new field of scholarship. And it's true that people are getting used to the notion that they could discover they have Jewish ancestors. Some people, some New Mexicans, as you know, embrace it. They actually change their identity and consider themselves Jewish when they find out about it, either from family tradition or from some genetic analysis But others won't have it and actually deny it. And there were relatives of the woman, the young woman I write about, who, particularly male relatives, who refused to participate in genetic counseling sessions that they really ought to have attended to learn about the risk of breast cancer in their female relatives. But they refused. They just said, no, that's not true, and I'm not going to any genetic counseling session to discuss it.
What is genetic counseling, and what were these sessions like in the San Luis Valley?
Well, genetic counselors actually were the ones who discovered this Jewish mutation in the Hispano population, because they're the ones who doctors will call them if they're treating somebody for cancer and they learn from the patient that there's a strong family history. Then they'll call a genetic counselor in who's not a doctor but understands the full package, if you will, of genetic risk, and they will counsel the patient and also the patient's relatives, because once you determine that somebody is carrying, let's say, this particular mutation, it really is very important, or it should be important that others who are at risk are informed, and getting them to the table to talk about the risks. Do you want to submit your blood, your DNA to an analysis? Because it's not guaranteed that everyone in the family will have it. But it does start as kind of a snowball, very problematic snowball effect, quite apart from whether it reveals your Jewish or not.
And so when people come to these sessions, I mean, there must be some sense of dread, like I might have this gene inside me, which is a ticking time bomb, and I can see people not wanting to know, but when they do know, what can they do with that information?
Well, I mean, if you're planning to have a family, if you're a male, and it can be carried, this mutation in men just as well as women, so if you're going to start a family, a man should tell his wife that. If you're a woman, if you're a young woman, it's obviously a much more charged situation. And the medical opinion is, I mean, you know, doctors like to intervene. Doctors like to kind of fix problems. So the notion of warding off breast cancer by having prophylactic mastectomies is many women are doing that. The more difficult cancer that this is related to is ovarian cancer. And as you know, that's a very dangerous cancer, hard to treat. So if a woman is told or is strongly urged that when she's past her childbearing years to have her ovaries out.
And some women in that extended family actually have done that. They've had their ovaries taken out. They've even had hysterectomies.
Yeah, hysterectomies is not normally part of it. But yes, there are some quite informed members of the family I wrote about, and then there are others who frankly didn't want to know. And it took the sister, for example, of Shawnee, my protagonist, it took her 5, 6, 8 years before she finally got up the courage to go and learn if she was positive for the mutation, and she wasn't, and unfortunately she is positive.
And what decisions did she make?
Well, she's not going to have the surgery, which is what many women do. And there is I write in the book about the advice of a conservative, ultra-Orthodox rabbi named Joseph Eckstein, who's against all this DNA testing. And he says, you know, don't mutilate yourself. Don't scar yourself. Just take extra care in terms of breast health. Get your mammograms. Get an MRI, which is recommended for carriers. And be extra vigilant. So there is that path that women can take if they don't want to have surgery.
Well, and then there's Shawnee Medina, who refused all medical treatment and died fairly quickly thereafter. She took homeopathy and sort of healthy eating, which seemed not to have done anything at all. And I found myself wondering whether if she and her family had been more informed from an earlier age, and this had been kind of part of her world to have a deeper scientific understanding of what was going on, whether she might have made different choices and still been with us.
Well, that's true. My wife has a phrase from Serbia, you know, if my mother-in-law had wheels, should be a truck. So we can wish, or we can imagine what it'd be like to come from a background perhaps a little more sophisticated and make other choices. But as I write in the book, I started out being kind of skeptical of the choice she made, but by the end, as I was told by her relatives, it was her choice, and I saw the cultural conditioning that led her to it, which was not just being a Jehovah's Witnesses, but strong Native American tradition of treating with natural remedies on her mother's side, which she endorsed. She was opposed to synthetic medicines. She was very she was vain, and she wanted her body. She wanted to look good, and she felt that she would be coming back to life, really, in the next world. And that's what witnesses believe. So there really were a lot of strong arguments from where she was sitting to lead her to the choice that she made. And I have to respect her free will on this.
It's such an interesting book because it really goes between the personal and cultural and genetic science and really weaves them all together in quite an unusual way. It's just an interesting and unusual work of journalism in a book form.
Well, there was an interview by David Steinberg in the paper last Sunday in your local paper, and he became quite interested in the formal question that you're asking, and I got a little carried away and started talking about cubism, but it's true that I wanted to carry a lot of streams or threads of information forward, all simultaneously, the way in a cubist painting by Braque or Picasso, you have these slashing planes of different currents kind of crashing into one another, and you're basically making a whole lot of fragments. And so that is that's perhaps the best, if not overly pompous, description of what I was trying to do.
Jeff Wheelwright's book is called The Wandering Gene and the Indian Princess, Race, Religion, and DNA. And tonight he will be speaking at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 7 in the evening. And then on Sunday he will be giving a lecture called Secret Jews and Telltale Genes in New Mexico. It's at the New Mexico History Museum here in Santa Fe at 2 in the afternoon. Now, do you have a book website you'd like to give to us?
It's jeffwheelwright.com. And if you can spell Jeff and you can spell Wheelwright and put them together, you will find my website.
Jeff with a J. Jeff Wheelwright, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.